Zen. Zest, zip, zap, and zing. Number 3. An Osho talk, given spontaneously at an outdoor meeting to an international audience of thousands of people.
The first question. I have been reflecting on the difference between feeling sorry for someone and having compassion. It seems to me that to be sorry for someone has an element of condescension in it, as if you were superior to the other, and that it does not necessarily have anything to do with love, whereas compassion must be an integral part of loving. Please comment. The first and the most important thing to remember is that reflecting is not going to help at all. Reflecting is nothing but a beautiful word for thinking. The blind man can go on thinking about light. He can arrive to certain conclusions too, but those conclusions cannot be right. Howsoever right they appear to be, they are bound to be false, untrue. The moon in the sky is one thing, and the moon reflected in the silent lake is totally another. One exists, the other is only a reflection. If you jump into the silent lake, you will not be able to catch hold of the moon. On the contrary, you may disturb even the reflection, because the lake will be disturbed. The more you think, the more you are creating waves and ripples in the mind. The real thing to do for the blind man is not to think about light, but to cure his eyes. For the deaf, not to reflect on music, but to go through some alchemical processes which can make him hear. That's the difference between reflection and meditation. Meditation opens your eyes. Reflection is thinking with closed eyes. Meditation is seeing, and thinking is remaining blind. But thinking can give you great conclusions, very logical too. In fact, only thinking can give you logical conclusions. Meditation will give you very paradoxical experiences, illogical or supralogical, but never logical. Existence consists of contradictions. It is vast enough to contain all contradictions. It consists of polar opposites. They appear opposites to the logical mind, but they are complementaries deep down in reality. They exist together in a kind of simultaneity. Meditation in English again has the same flavor as reflection. In English there is not a word which can be said equivalent to dhyana or zen. So we have to use the word meditation that comes the closest. But few conditions have to be put upon it. The moment you use the word meditation, the immediate question arises on what? Because meditation in the English language means meditating upon something. And the word dhyana or zen simply means emptying yourself from all thinking. It is not a question of meditating upon something. Meditation is a state of absolute silence, of profound peace, of not thinking at all, but just being aware. Only in that awareness you will be able to see the truth. You say that I have been reflecting on the difference between feeling sorry for someone and having compassion. And you can see immediately the difficulty. Feeling sorry for someone and having compassion are exactly the same. The person who knows what compassion is cannot say, I am having compassion. He is simply compassionate. Having compassion is not possible. Either you are compassionate or you are not. It is not a question of having. If you are having compassion, it is the same in different words, feeling sorry. But language can give you great scope to play games, mind games. Feeling sorry and having compassion are synonymous. Of course, feeling sorry, having compassion are synonymous, but feeling sorry and being compassionate are not synonymous. Being compassionate is a totally different phenomenon than having compassion. Having compassion, again you will have that idea that I am far superior than the others. Look how much compassion I have got. And compassion is not something that you can possess. It is not something that you can have. You can only be. Know the difference between having and being. But you have been groping, and something significant has arisen out of your groping. You say, it seems to me that to be sorry for someone has an element of condescension in it, as if you were superior to the other. Yes, even the blind man can grope for the door and can sometimes find it. But still he will not be able to see it. It is just accidental. That's why you are not certain. Seeing has absolute certainty about it. Seeing is knowing, and knowing is not approximate. You say, it seems to me. Naturally, if you are reflecting, at the most it can seem to you that this is the door. Perhaps this is the door. The perhaps will always surround you, and with the perhaps one is in a kind of bondage. There will be ifs and buts. You will never be on a certain ground, and without being on a certain ground, you cannot be centered. There will remain some wavering. Maybe it is so, maybe it is not so. It seems, you say to me, that to be sorry for someone has an element of condescension in it. It has. There is no question of being uncertain about it. In fact, people enjoy being sorry for others. They are always looking for situations where they can feel sorry for others. It is so ego-fulfilling. It is such a nourishment for the ego. If somebody's house is on fire, you go with tears in your eyes and you show all sympathy. You show much concern, as if you are immensely pained. But deep down, if you watch, you will find a certain joy, a certain glee. But people never look within themselves. It is bound to be there. For two reasons: that it is not your house that is on fire, first thing. Thank God. Secondly, you must be enjoying your tears. Because when somebody makes a new house, a beautiful house, you feel jealous. Great envy arises in you. You cannot enjoy. You cannot participate in his joy. You want to avoid, you don't even look at his house. I used to go to Calcutta. I used to stay in a very beautiful house. And the man was the owner of the house. Was immensely concerned about the house. He was very rich, one of the richest in Calcutta, and he had no children. So just the wife and the husband, and nothing else to do. So they had maintained the house, the garden, the lawns, with great care. And whenever I will go, he will take me around, watch new things they have done. The last time I went, he didn't talk about the house, the garden, the swimming pool. I was puzzled. That was so abnormal of him. 24 hours passed and the house was not mentioned at all. new paintings that he has acquired and the new antique furniture. The new antique furniture. And how much it has cost him. And he was looking a little bit sad too. I asked, "What is the matter? You look very sad." He said, "Yes, I am sad." He took me out into the lawn and showed me a house in the neighborhood. A new house has come up. And he said, "Unless I can defeat this man, I will remain sad." The neighbor invited me for a lunch. He wanted the owner of the house, also my host, to come with me, but he immediately refused. I had to go alone. When I came back, he said, "Don't take any note of my refusal. I cannot go into that house unless I have made a bigger house than him. I cannot go there. It hurts. I am feeling humiliated." If you cannot participate in the joy of others, how you can feel sorry when they are in trouble? If you feel jealous when they are joyous, then you will feel joyous when they are in trouble, but you will not sow it. You will sow sympathy. Sympathy is not a good word. Few words are very ugly but have become very much respected. Words like duty, service, sympathy, these are ugly words. A man who is fulfilling his duty is not a man of love. A man who is doing service knows nothing of love, because service is not done. It happens. And the man who sympathizes certainly is enjoying some kind of superiority, that I am not in that sorry state. The other is in the sorry state. I have the upper hand. I can feel sorry for him. In Jabalpur, I lived for 20 years. The richest man in Jabalpur used to come to me once in a while. He said one day that one thing troubles me always. I have been helping all of my relatives, even far away relatives. I have made them all rich in every possible way. But nobody feels friendly with me. In fact, I feel a certain antagonism from all of my relatives. Why is it so? And I have done so much for them. And there was no need for me to do for them. I did out of love. But they feel antagonistic. I said, "I know your relatives. They also visit me. And I know that they are antagonistic to you. And the reason is very simple. You have never allowed them to do anything for you. You have always been doing things for them. And you have never allowed them to do even a small thing for you. You have not even asked them to bring a rose flower for you. So they are all feeling humiliated. And it is not love that you are talking about. It is just ego. that I have done so much. You want to show them that I have done so much and I don't need anybody to do anything for me. That's why there is antagonism. Of course you have done with good intentions, but intentions don't count. The unconscious desire for ego fulfillment, for ego gratification is hurting them. I said to him, once in a while, give them few chances. I know that you don't need, but they have beautiful gardens. You can tell them, sometime bring roses for me. Sometimes you fall ill. You can ask them to come and just sit by your side. And they will all feel happy. Just the small things. Sometimes you can tell them, invite me for a supper, for a dinner, and they will be immensely enjoyed. And they will not feel antagonism. He said, that I cannot do. That is impossible. That is against my nature, he said. Then I told him, then it is absolutely clear now, even you can see it, why all your good deeds have brought antagonism. These do-gooders are mischievous people. They do good, but their desire is just the opposite of it. The idea of feeling superior to the other is present in both the cases, whether you feel sorry or you are having compassion. And you say, and that it does not necessarily have anything to do with love. Certainly it does not necessarily have anything to do with love. Not only that, it is anti-love, because it is an ego trip. And ego can never be in tune with love. Ego is poison to love. It is necessarily anti-love. Your compassion is not out of love. If some desire of being superior is being fulfilled by it, the lover never feels superior. The lover cannot feel superior. The lover cannot even think that he has obliged anybody. On the contrary, when somebody receives your love, you feel obliged that your love was not rejected. It could have been rejected. Your love was respected, welcomed. You feel obliged, you feel thankful, you feel grateful. And you say, whereas compassion must be an integral part of loving. No, compassion is higher than love. Love is an integral part of compassion, but compassion is not an integral part of love. That's the difference between thinking and meditation. These three things are to be taken note of. The lowest love is sex. It is physical. And the highest refinement of love is compassion. Sex is below love. Compassion is above love. Love is exactly the middle. Very few people know what love is. 99% of people, unfortunately, think sexuality is love. It is not. Sexuality is very animal. It certainly has the potential of growing into love, but it is not actual love, only potentiality. A seed is not a flower. It can become a flower, but there is no certainty, no guarantee that it is going to become a flower. It may die as a seed. If you put it on a rock, it will not sprout into a bush, into a flowering tree. It will die. If you throw it in fire, it will die. Sex has the potential of love, but only the potential, remember. It is the seed. There is no need to deny it, because if you throw the seed, if you deny the seed, then love disappears. That's why in the so-called religious people, you will not find love and its warmth. You will find them cold, dead, without love. Yes, they will be having compassion. They will feel sorry for you because you are hell-bound, and they are going to heaven. Naturally, they feel sorry for you, poor souls. You will suffer hellfire, and they will be enjoying the pleasures of heaven. There is no love at all, but they are having compassion. And having compassion is a pseudo thing. It is not the true compassion. They have denied sex, and in denying sex, they have denied love. Sex has to be used in the right perspective. It has not to be repressed. It has not to be denied, and you are not to remain confined to it either. No repression, no indulgence. The path is very subtle. Jesus says, the path is straight but very narrow. It is a razor's edge. Sex either becomes indulgence, as it has become in the West, or it becomes repression, as it has become in the East. On one side, there is a well if you fall, on another side, there is a ditch. You have to bark between the two. Certainly it is a razor's edge, a tight rope walking. You have to remain very balanced. And the functioning of the mind is such that it moves from one polarity to the other. It is exactly like the pendulum of an old clock. It goes from the right to the left, extreme left, and from the extreme left again to the extreme right. And remember the law. While you see the pendulum moving towards the left, it is gaining momentum to go to the right. While it is going actually towards the right, it is gaining momentum to go to the left. So don't be deceived what you see. Something inside is growing which is just the opposite of what you are seeing. The repressed person is always ready to go into indulgence. All the repressed societies are boiling, ready to go into indulgence. And they find ways and means to go into indulgence. For example, this country has repressed sex for thousands of years, and the natural outcome has been a backdoor indulgence. In Indian temples, prostitutes have existed. In the South, still, even today, in the 20th century, temples are having prostitutes. They are not called prostitutes. Indians are very clever in giving beautiful names to ugly things. They are called Devadasis, servants of God. And who are these gods? First, the priest. Initiates them into sex indulgence. And then the rich clients who come to the temple. These are the gods whom they serve. But they are supposed to serve the stone statue of the god inside the temple. That is just a facade. Now in India, prostitution can exist only in a religious garb. Sex has been such a taboo that you have to find some way to make it religious. Temples like Khajuraho, Konark, Puri have not existed anywhere in the West. There is no need. People are already indulging. They are indulging on the front doors. So there is no need to go from the back door. It is not a coincidence that the first treatise on sex was written in India. What Sigmund Freud has done and Wilhelm Reich and Masters and Johnson and other sex researchers is nothing compared to what Vatsyayana's sutras, Kama sutras, sex sutras, and they are 3,000 years old. After every great religion was born in India, from the back door entered Tantra in a rationalized form, just nothing but sexuality. 99% of it is sexuality. There is Buddhist Tantra. Buddha could not have conceived it, that his followers are going to make sex a religious ritual. But what people can do, if you repress them too much, then they have to find ways, otherwise they are continuously burning with desire. Hindu Tantra, very ugly. If you just look at the Tantra paintings, you will be surprised. And these are the people who say that I am destroying their culture. And what kind of culture they have got. Khajuraho and Tantra treatises and Vatsayana's Kama Sutra and Pandit Kok's Kama Sutras. What culture they have got. All this nonsense has happened because sex was repressed. In the West, sex became indulgence. Both are wrong. But that's how the mind is. It always goes from the frying pan to the fire. It cannot stay in the middle. Because to stay in the middle is the death of the mind. That's what I call meditation. If you can stay exactly in the middle, the clock stops. If the pendulum stays in the middle, hold the pendulum in the middle and the clock stops. And hold yourself exactly in the middle. Avoid the extreme and the excess, and suddenly you will see that mind has stopped. Mind functions almost like a clock. Sex is a potential, great potential. If you become aware and alert, meditative, then sex can be transformed into love. And if your meditativeness becomes total, absolute, love can be transformed into compassion. Sex is the seed, love is the flower, compassion is the fragrance. Compassion has love as one of its ingredients, but not vice versa. Love is not compassionate. You can see it everywhere. Lovers are continuously fighting. They are intimate enemies, continuously at each other's neck. Yes, once in a while, just to rest, they are loving too. But those love breaks are far and few in between. Otherwise, there is constant struggle, fight. The woman is nagging, that is her way of fighting. And the man is always ready to hit hard on the woman's head. In fact, people think when you don't fight, your love has died. Psychologists also agree with these fools. They say that if you don't fight, that means you are not interested. If you don't fight, that simply means it does not matter. If it matters, then you have to fight. Lovers are fighting. There is no compassion. There is cruelty. And you can see that cruelty in their love making also. For thousands of years, people have been making love in dark for the simple reason because it looks ridiculous, aggressive. Lovers are not related in a compassionate way. It is a fight to grab as much as possible, to give as less as possible and to get as more as possible. It is a bargain. It is a business. People are forcing each other to give as much love in every possible way, direct and indirect. It is cruelty. It is violence. It is aggression. Once in a while it has happened that lovers have killed each other. That seems to be the extreme form of love. Just the very climax. They bite, they scratch with their nails. Vatsyayana says these are methods of love. Scratching the beloved with your nails and biting your beloved so blood comes. These are love methods, love techniques. Vatsyayana must have been some kind of sadist, but Indians call him a rishi, a seer. Maharishi, a great seer, must have been like Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, a great seer. And all this nonsense he is writing and giving techniques. It is called love bite, love scratch. And he says it makes love making very deep, profound. You must have heard about De Sade, on whose name sadism has been coined. De Sade seems to be the greatest lover in the world. He used to carry a suitcase with himself, just like a doctor's suitcase, with all the instruments. Of course, he was far more modern than Vatsyayana. Why scratch with nails if you can have beautiful instruments to scratch? Why bite with your teeth if you can have devices? And a Western man, technology oriented, he had all kinds of instruments in his bed, and he had a beautiful personality. Women became attracted to him, and he was very rich. He was a marquis. And once a woman will enter into his love chamber, it was called love chamber. In fact, it should be called torture chamber. He will immediately lock the door. And the woman will be puzzled, because on all the walls there were other bigger instruments. Whips and all kinds of things. And then he will undress the woman and will start beating her. And even the women who had been in love with him, of course they never dared to go again, once was enough. But they confessed before the court, almost all the women, because he had made love to many women, hundreds. He was rich enough to pay. But all the women confessed in the court that the way he made love to them always was dangerous. And they were very much scared, but they had never such beautiful orgasms, neither before nor after. And De Sade writes in his memoirs that when you beat a woman, she becomes really aroused. When you whip her, she becomes alive, warm, certainly, obviously. Lovers don't have compassion on each other. You may not be a disade, but every lover is on the way. Disade may be the goal, very few reach to that height. Love has no ingredient of compassion in it. The vice versa is true. Compassion certainly has love in it, but because of compassion, that love has a totally different quality, a different flavor. The word compassion has to be understood. When passion is transformed, it is called compassion. When passion goes through absolute transformation, it is compassion. Love is a stage on the way, but not the end. Buddha has defined compassion as love plus meditation. When your love is not just a desire for the other, when your love is not only a need, when your love is a sharing, when your love is not that of a beggar, but that of an emperor, when your love is not asking for something in return, but is ready only to give, give for the sheer joy of giving, then add meditation to it, and then the pure fragrance is released. The imprisoned splendor is released. That is compassion. Compassion is the highest phenomenon. Sex is animal. Love is human. Compassion is divine. Sex is physical. Love is psychological. Compassion is spiritual. And again, let me remind you that it is not having compassion, it is being compassion. You can have sex, you can have love, but less than sex. But you cannot have compassion. You become compassion. Your very being is compassion. Walking, you are compassionate. Sitting, you are compassionate. Sleeping, you are compassionate. Whether anybody is there or not does not matter. Your compassion is just like a flame. It goes on burning in absolute aloneness, radiating. If somebody passes by, he can have it with no strings attached to it, with no conditions. Compassion is the experience of the Buddhas, of the awakened. You cannot reflect on these matters. Stop reflecting. Don't waste your energy in reflecting. Put the whole energy into meditation. Become silent, aware, watchful. And in that watchfulness, miracles happen. And everybody is entitled to this miracle of becoming compassion. It is our birthright. The second question. The other day, you were talking about hugging and kissing as an expression of freedom. After discourse, an Indian sannyasin was swaying and hugging a Western woman sannyasin, and it looked so ugly to see. It did not feel at all like love. It seemed that he was trying to utilize the word freedom as a result of your discourse. The Indian mind is in a very perverted state. Here, my Indian sannyasins consist of three categories. The first, the best, who have come here for spiritual growth, who have come to inquire about truth, about meditation, about freedom, about God. The second, who are very repressed and who have not come to inquire about freedom, truth, liberation, meditation. They are boiling with repression, which is the normal state of the Indian society outside. Here they have come just to use this freedom that I am giving to my people. Of course, their love will look ugly because it is not love. It is simply perverted sex. It is sex standing on its head. And the third category consists only of curious people who have not come because of any reason, just to see what is happening. They come and go. They are not the problem. But the problem is that they come and only see the second type of Indians, hugging and kissing in an ugly way. And they spread the rumors all over the country that what is happening here. They don't see the best Indians who are really in tune with me. 90% of my sannyasins, Indian sannyasins, belong to the first category, the best people. 9% belong to the second category, the ugly people, the fools. They have not come here for me. Some have come because there are so many beautiful women around. Some have come to cheat, to borrow money, to steal. We are trying to throw them out, but still, few somehow manage to enter in. They even meditate to show that they are meditators. But their real motive is totally different. Whenever you find that any Indian sannyasin is misusing the freedom available here, throw him out immediately and ban him. When two Westerners are hugging each other, there is a beauty in it. Because they are not coming from a repressed society. They have not come here just to hug. They could have hugged far better in the West. There was no need to come thousands of miles to this dirty place, Pune, to be sick with hepatitis and amoebas and dengue fever and suffer all kinds of troubles, to be raped by Indians, to be killed by people, murdered, beaten. They have not come here just to hug and kiss. That is beautifully available in the West. They have come here to seek and search for something which is not available there. So when they are hugging each other, there is no sex involved in it. It is just a sharing. But the Indian stupids who are here, those 9%, they are only here to hug and kiss. Poor fellows, they have even to meditate. They have to do vipassana. They go through all kinds of tortures, because these are tortures for them. But they suffer all these tortures. And this is my experience, that the Western people are far more innocent. Naturally, because they come from a richer society, affluent, free society, without any taboos, they are innocent, childlike, and they become easily involved with these cunning people, these cunning Indians. I want my Western sannyasins also to be a little watchful and aware. Avoid these ugly people. Those people are not the right people to commune with. And to all the guards and to the office, I would like to tell that whenever you find some ugly thing happening here, immediately throw the person out. The freedom is for beauty. For anything that is beautiful, there is freedom. But not for ugly things to happen. They should not be allowed, at least not in my commune. My commune has to live up to the highest standards of beauty, love, compassion, meditation. But because we are in India, and once in a while somebody is bound to enter in, so be a little alert and careful. Immediately stop such people from the ashram. I don't want to have to do anything with such kind. And freedom certainly can be used, misused too. Only freedom can be misused. If there is no freedom, then there is no question of any misuse. That's why societies have not allowed freedom. They have made a very strict discipline for people. They have made a very repressed structure around people. For the simple reason that freedom is dangerous. It can be misused. Slavery cannot be misused. What the slave can do? And the Indians live in an absolute slavery outside this ashram. And when they come in, of course, they are coming with all kinds of scorpions and snakes and dogs within them. And they start freeing all kinds of repressed, perverted desires, because they have never seen such freedom. Freedom can be used only by people who are very aware. Repressed people cannot use it. They are bound to misuse it. I have heard many other stories about this Indian, whosoever he is. If he has any sense, he should immediately stop doing such acts. Or if he cannot, then this is not the place for him. He should leave, otherwise he will be thrown out. I know the name of the person, but I will not tell the name here. He will understand. So whomsoever it may concern, the last question: what should be done so that people can understand you? I feel very sad to see so much misunderstanding about you and your teachings. It is natural in a way. It is not unusual. It is expected that people will misunderstand me. They have always misunderstood the truth, the naked truth. And they are very slow. So they always get the joke very late. They started understanding Buddha when he was dead. They started understanding Socrates when they themselves has killed him. They started having respect for Jesus when they crucified him. They themselves. Now they remember with great respect the name of Al-Hillaz Mansur and Sarmad, whom they themselves destroyed. People are very slow in understanding. Recently, a letter of Gauguin is sold for over $5,000. In it, the painter complained of his poverty, that he was starving to death. Now the letter is being sold for $5,000. And the painter is complaining in the letter that he is starving. Starving to death. People are strange. They take such a long time to understand. Vincent van Gogh's paintings are worshipped now all over the world. Now they say that he was one of the greatest painters ever. But while he was alive, not a single painting was sold. Now each painting is valued near about $1 million. Only 200 paintings are in existence. If he was alive, he would have been the richest man now. But he was so poor while he was alive that in a week he will eat only for 3 days. He used to get from his brother enough money to eat the cheapest food for the whole week. But he had to save a little money for canvases and paintings and color and brushes. So he had to starve for 4 days to save a little money. He committed suicide when he was only 33. Just because it was so difficult to survive. Nobody will accept his paintings. There was no question of anybody purchasing. Even people refused to accept to hang his paintings in their houses. He will present his paintings free to people and they will throw them in the basement or somewhere else. His brother, thinking that he feels so sad that he has not sold a single painting in his life, sent one man with some money that go and purchase one painting. The man went. Wanga could not believe his eyes that there is one man in the world who is ready to purchase. So he sold with great interest his painting, but the man was not interested in the paintings at all. He said, any painting will do. You keep this money and give me the painting. Immediately he understood what is the matter. He said, forget about purchasing the painting. It seems my brother has sent you. So take this money back. It is better to die without selling a painting. And the same day he committed suicide. It was enough. He painted near about 1,000 paintings. 800 paintings had been lost because people never cared about them. When his paintings started becoming famous after his death, people started searching for his paintings. And they were found in all kinds of places, people's basements, bathrooms. And they were purchased easily. People were very willing to give a little money and or even without money. Now each single painting is evaluated as $1 million. That's how people always have functioned. So nothing unnatural about it. People have their own understanding. Two kids were talking. What are you going to ask Santa Claus to give you for Christmas? I want an astronaut suit. And you? I want a tampon. A tampon? What is that? I don't know. But on the TV, they say that with it you can travel everywhere, swim, play. Now, small children are small children. They have their understanding. Now, this tampon, something magical. You can travel anywhere, everywhere, swim, play, do whatsoever you want. The apples on a farmer's tree had just ripened. The owner put a notice under the tree which said, "Don't steal, God is watching you." The day after the farmer found his apple tree had been picked bare. On the notice, the thief had added a few more words, but he is not a spy. two members of the town council begin shouting at each other, "You are the biggest idiot in the world," the first shouted, "and you are the most bigoted and prejudiced donkey in town," the other man yelled. The mayor, who was presiding, banged his gavel and said, "Quiet, gentlemen, quiet, please. I am afraid that in your excitement you have forgotten that I am in the room too." The psychiatrist was talking to his patient. "Well," he said, "your problem has sexual origins. I have to ask you something about your sexual behavior. Do you talk to your husband while making love?" "Well, yes," answered the woman. "I mean, only if there happens to be a telephone nearby." A man called on his lawyer and said, "I want to sue that man who lives across the street from me. He called me a hippopotamus." "We can do that," the lawyer said. "When did he call you that?" "6 years ago," the man replied. "6 years ago?" The lawyer exclaimed, "Why have you waited so long to file suit against him?" "Well," the man said, "yesterday I took the kids to the zoo, and it was the first time I had ever seen a hippopotamus." You ask me what should be done so that people can understand you. In fact, nothing can be done. If you understand me, that live that understanding, that's all. If somebody is ready to understand it, good. If nobody is ready to understand it, nothing to bother about. That is their business. Don't become too much concerned about others, because that concern will disturb your own growth. You grow according to your inner light. And if you are full of light, maybe some people will start understanding. If my sannyasins start living exactly what I mean, then that's enough. Few people will certainly understand you. And only few are possible to understand it. The larger mob is incapable of understanding anything that goes beyond them. But that is their freedom. If they don't want to understand, it has not to be forced upon them. A drunk was weaving around the bar of an exclusive hotel. He asked the barman the way to the men's toilet, and he was told that it was the first floor on the right down the hall. So he blundered through the first door on the left and fell into the swimming pool. He had been treading water for well over 5 minutes when the door opened. "For God's sake," he screamed, "don't flush it yet." And the really last question: do you take yourself seriously? Never. Seriousness and me have nothing in common. There is no bridge between me and seriousness. Did you hear the latest joke? Bhagwan goes to the psychiatrist. Says the psychiatrist, This is the first time you have come to me, so please tell me your story from the very beginning. Replies Bhagwan, in the beginning I created the sky and the earth. Enough for today.